Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Please take your seats quickly, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to Tennis Weekly with Joel, Kim and Chris. On today's tour catch-up, sponsored by DownloadTennis.com,
Sabalenka edge Swiatek sail into the quarterfinals,
Medvedev edges Zverev,
and Emma Raducanu rediscovers her mojo in Indian Wells.
Chris, today is the 15th of March and we are here to catch up on the week in tennis at Tennis Weekly HQ, specially backed by our crowd funders, Conan Minnick and Pat Lowe. It's just the two of us today. Listeners may be wondering why the show started ever so slightly different to normal. And the reason for that is Joel's got concussion. He's had a slight knock to the head and he's not doing so well. So we've put him off to rest for a week. No screens. Sadly, no tennis watching as a result. But he'll have to listen to loads of back episodes of Tennis Weekly, I think.
Audio only, I've been told. But I think we've got to paint the picture a little bit more there, that Joel was actually injured by a hockey ball to the head. So that could be a big surprise to our listeners that he actually plays more hockey than tennis. But he has been ordered that he must not be staring at screens, so we can tell him what's happening in the tennis, because he can't find out for himself, Kim.
Yeah, he's got no idea what's happening in the tennis world, so he's eagerly anticipating this episode so he can catch up with what he's missed, because he hasn't been able to watch
any of it. He is okay, though, we should make clear. He is okay. Yes.
Yeah, he is okay. He's recovering, and we wish him back safe and sound. Many of our listeners may have been wondering, where he is, but yeah, he's doing okay. It's not a tennis-related injury or a podcast-related injury, fortunately, but the two of us will be here to cap what's happened so far in Indian Wells. We're now at the quarterfinal stage, so there's loads to look forward to and loads to catch up on, as well as lots of other news going on in the tennis world. Chris, I wasn't with you guys last week. I was off in Mallorca, kind of having a bit of sun, avoiding the snow in the UK. But how have you been over the past few weeks?
Yes, well, we were all very jealous here at Tennis Weekly HQ, because you sent us that picture of yourself on a balcony. I think it was actually a video of yourself on a balcony, or rooftop terrace, I should say, enjoying a Hugo. And so my big mission is to try and find out from you, what is a Hugo?
What is a Hugo? Well, yes. So a Hugo is a cocktail, and it just originates, I think, from the Alpine kind of region. But it's very simply, it's like Prosecco, basically, with elderflower, cordial, some soda water and a sprig of mint. And it's very, very nice and refreshing. So, yeah, if any listeners fancy a new cocktail, quite nice for the summer, then get yourself a Hugo. But they are my favourite favourite rooftop bar drink. Not that I'm on a rooftop bar as frequently as I would like, but but Joel better stay off them, because I don't think alcohol mixes well with concussion, so he'll have to wait to try one of those, I think. What's been your highlight so far, at Indian Wells? We've had so much tennis going on. We've had lots of Brits in action as well, including, somewhat a bit of a resurgence for Emma Raducanu, which has been a lovely surprise. Also Jack Draper doing well. What's been your highlight so far from the last week on the tour, Chris?
Well, I have to say, sticking to our theme of French male tennis players, I'm very pleased to see that Gael is back on tour, Gael Monfils, that he's back. His results might not have been fantastic since he has returned, but very welcome that he's back on the tour after having a real bad run of injury. And so for me, I think it's seeing him kind of the scenes in Indian Wells where he's kind of embracing players, having finally got back to training and being in person with all of them. And I think his wife is actually, Elena Monfils, is also returning in Charleston. So I think it's very good to get one of tennis's power couples back on the tour. And I think we're only going to see good things from Gale. He said, though, one thing I should warn all of our listeners about, if he does get injured again, he's going to call it time. So everyone, fingers crossed that he does not get injured, but he doesn't always have the best track record when it comes to that. So here's hoping he can stay healthy the rest of the year.
Yeah, because he seems to be injured on and off quite a lot. So for him to say that obviously shows you where I guess his mindset is at. He's very frustrated, I guess, with so many injuries all over, you know, over the years. But I assume he means a more significant injury, not just like, you know, a cut finger.
Or a hockey ball to the temple, you know.
Or a hockey ball to the temple. I'm also surprised that his wife is coming back. I felt like they'd only just had their baby, but obviously time has moved on and I'm, you know, back in last year. But it's good to see that she's going to be coming back soon. You know, we have missed her on the tour. She's such a solid player and, you know, has been up there, you know, there and thereabouts for years now. So I think her presence has been missed and she'll be, you know, very, very warmly welcomed when she does return to the tour. I'm going to be a bit cheeky and my highlight for the week actually is not related to Indian Wells, and listeners won't be surprised when I tell you that it relates to something to do with Rafa. And I thought this news was quite funny this week, and that's the fact that there's going to be a statue built of Rafa in Mallorca, I think, and it's going to include him and his water bottles. So it's going to look towards his family home in Manacor, which is sort of the second biggest city of the island. And they're going to do a statue of him.
And
it's going to include bottles placed as he likes to do. And there's going to be an inscription highlighting his values. So it's going to be kind of, I think, one of those more interactive sculptures where you can kind of engage with it. I think it's going to be him sitting on a wall kind of thing, rather than just standing like that or playing, you know, tennis like that one at Roland Garros. So I quite like those statues. Wow. I walk past one on my way to work sometimes. There's a seated statue of John Keats. So I'm quite excited by this.
I know exactly where that is, Kim. But
what, the statue of John Keats?
Yeah, I feel like I do.
Oh, but it's at Guy's Hospital in London, if anyone wants to go there.
No water bottles, though, I don't think there. So, like,
no water bottles.
Is he bending over to adjust them? Is that what we're thinking for this one? Or are we thinking they're more just symbolic as part of his whole shtick?
I don't think he's going to be bending over in the statue, but I think they're just there as, you know, as symbolic. Hopefully they won't get defaced or, you know, anything like that.
A symbol of recycling in Mallorca.
Yeah. Don't leave your bottles on the floor like Rafa. Go and put them
exactly
in a bin. But yeah, I've just been to Manacor, so I'm going to have to go back when the statue is unveiled to see it in person. But it's quite exciting. But yeah, I mean, we're not here to talk about, I guess, statues, are we? As much as we'd love to. But let's talk about Indian Wells, because we've had loads of action. We're at the quarterfinal stage. Let's begin with the women's draw, Chris. Your bread and butter, so to speak. What's been your standout story from the first week on the women's side of the draw at Indian Wells?
Well, I mean, I'm going to be predictable, but it has to be the return of Emma Raducanu to form. I think what makes it so great this week is that she talked about the fact she hadn't been able to practice in the way that she wanted to. She obviously had that wrist injury was coming back. She'd had tonsillitis. You know, when it rains, it pours, it seemed to be for the British number one. And she was able to turn up and play some fantastic tennis to upset this year's Australian Open semi-finalist and Joel's, one of Joel's favourites, Magda Linette. And then backing that up with a win over the world number 13, her second highest win so far. Highest win was against Bencic at the US Open in 2021. So there is some symbolism there. She's won three matches in a row, the second time since that run. So it feels like, even though it might have ended in a slight loss, that it was a really great week for her. And I have to say, I was glued to the Haddad Maia match. That was exceptional tennis. I mean, the first set was massive hitting. And the Raducanu from the US Open, she was taking on the ball. She was right inside the baseline. And so for me, seeing what looked like an almost 100% Raducanu playing Raducanu-style tennis, I just think it's so great to see, because she's been so unlucky. And I think it's one of those things where we need to remember just how talented she is, because despite the hiccups that she might have had, when she steps onto a tennis court playing well, it really is something to behold.
Yeah, and I think just seeing those stats, actually, that she hadn't had three consecutive wins since her run at the US Open, you know, until now, that's like well over a year and a half. And that just shows you really how much injury woe she's had and, you know, form struggles, and the fact that also she's never beaten a top 10 player on the tour, you know. So it's great for her to get that win against Haddad Maia, who's just outside the top 10. But yeah, real positives, I think, just with the form that we saw. You know, she may have come a cropper against Iga Świątek in the early hours of this morning in the UK. You know, she only won four games against Iga Świątek, but I feel like
more
despite
than most,
how
Kim, it's more than most.
Yeah, exactly. That's it's a deluge of games compared to what some people have got against Świątek. But I think, you know, considering how well Świątek, you know, has been playing as well, and being the world number one, it was always going to be a tough ask. So I'm not surprised.
She
really
played very well. I watched
and
that.
She did play well.
I watched that this morning. Woke up extra early and she was everywhere. I couldn't believe how well she was defending out of the corners. I mean, whatever Raducanu hit, Świątek managed to get behind the ball and put it back, even with more depth than Raducanu hit it with. So she was almost a human wall that also had some serious hitting potential. I mean, it was, a bit devastating that second set, to be honest.
Yeah, it sort of ran away from Emma, I think, didn't it? Because Iga won the last six games.
God mode was engaged, it seemed.
A bagel. The Polish bakery.
Yes, it was a bagel.
Yeah, and Świątek will go on to play Sorana Castella, who did upset podcast favourite Caroline Garcia in a three-set tussle. Castella, one of those players that is very often, you know, is there to cause an upset, isn't she? So a bit frustrating for Garcia, but do you think Castella can continue her, you know, her run here against Świątek, or is she just gonna, you know, how many games is she gonna get, or do you think she could pull off the unthinkable?
Well, she's gone a bit under the radar, hasn't she, so far this year. I think she hasn't been kind of getting that many wins, but she does love to play against, you know, one of those top ranked players. She won't be intimidated by the nature of that situation. I think potentially it's going to be one-way traffic, purely because the nature of the court and the nature of Iga is that she really does get back. And I think she probably is the best defender on the tour and the best mover on the tour. And Castella is all about hitting winners. And so I think if you're able to kind of do sort of a similar thing in terms of the Raducanu match, I think she will be able to weave her web and make that very difficult for Castella to get the ball through the court.
Yeah, I think so. I quite like a bit of Sorana Castella. You know, I've seen her quite a bit of Grand Slams, and she's always involved, I feel like, with very entertaining matches. But I'm not so sure that the one against Świątek is going to be quite so close and entertaining. What I think would be the more entertaining clash from this side of the draw is the Muchova-Rybakina quarterfinal, because I think that's quite an interesting matchup. Rybakina doing very well to come through the draw so far in straight sets, and Muchova also coming through, beaten Azarenka and Vondrousova so far. But we know Muchova on her day, you know, can cause an upset as well, a bit like a Castella, but perhaps a slightly different level. Joel had predicted Rybakina to win the title. She's looking good so far. So where do you think Rybakina's going to fare in this tournament? Do you think she could be the one maybe going further to upset Świątek's apple cart maybe?
Well, I think the nature of the court, it does suit a player who might not naturally be the quickest of movers, because it gives them a bit more time to get behind the ball. And that's why I think it looks like Iga's got so much time. So I think if you're a big hitter, and she is, and you're able to kind of play it almost a little bit like a clay court in that sense, I think it's going to be a really interesting encounter. I think that match with Muchova, I think that will be particularly interesting at this stage in the quarterfinal. And I think whoever wins that match will be highly entertaining. But Rybakina had some injury woes coming in. You know, we weren't sure. There was a question mark. And I said, Joel, it was very bold of him to predict Rybakina to win this one, because she did have to pull out of her last match prior to this. But she's beaten, you know, Grand Slam champion in Kenin, former champion in Badosa, and then obviously a bit more straight sailing against Goracheva. But obviously she had a great result in Dallas. So She's beating some form players and making it look pretty straightforward. So I would say that's probably my prediction for this area, that I reckon that's probably what we're going to end up having. An eager Świątek match. We would definitely have that.
She's been split into two.
It's the only person who can beat her is herself, maybe. You can delve into that if you want to and unpack what's going on there. But no, Rebecca, no, I think it will be her kryptonite in the sense that will face off.
Also a battle of the slam champions as well, really. And just, I have to move, before we move on to the other part of the draw, Chris, Sloane Stephens against Sophia Kenin, that did catch my eye in the draw. You know, two former Grand Slam champions, American players.
Yes.
Straight sets Kenin. I assume you got up in the middle of the night to watch this match as well, as you do for Sloane.
Yeah, it was... It was unfortunate. I think Kenin did play very well, but I just think we've been in a bit of a tricky spot with Sloane this last couple of years in terms of what's going to happen with her game and where her kind of commitment is to tennis. And I think it's not as focused as she could be at some of these moments. I'm hoping we get a clay court resurgence like we did last year with a quarterfinal in Paris, but Miami... She's won it before, so I'm staying optimistic in that sense that there's still a little bit of hardcore hope left this year.
Yes, let's see what she does over the next half of the Sunshine Double. And then let's look at the other results from the ladies' side, because Australian Open champion Aryna Sabalenka, she's doing well. She has benefited from a walkover, but she had a tough match against Barbora Krejcikova, who I think you were tipping quite a bit, weren't you, Chris, of late?
Yes.
But it was Sabalenka that came out on top in their round of 16 clash. What did you make of that match and Sabalenka's performance?
Well, I was watching it yesterday and I do think it was a bit topsy-turvy. I don't think either of those players would say that they played their best tennis in that one. It both had moments where they played well. It was quite stop and start in terms of the tennis and, you know, it'd be a missed second serve return and then a winner off a first serve. So it was one of those sorts of matches where it was about getting the win and winning ugly if you needed to. So not pretty, but finding a way to win is obviously, you know, what the champions do and what the champions do best. And Sabalenka was able to edge that. It was super tight in that final set. It was 5-4 and it went to juice in that game. I can't quite remember if there's a break point or not, but it could have gone either way, that clash. So I think a bit of revenge there from what happened in Dubai, where she actually bageled Krejcikova in that first set and then kind of went on to lose that match. So having picked up a relatively straightforward first set, she must have been thinking, surely not again. But no, I think it was a solid performance. And, you know, she's moved to 15-1 for the season. So I think we kind of forget that, obviously, she did pick up that title prior to Australia. And that I think a lot of people would love to see a Sabalenka Świątek final.
I think that's what I've got, I think.
Oh,
but
is it, Kim?
I mean...
Is it, Kim? You missed the prediction.
Hey, it hasn't
episode,
happened yet.
Suddenly, you're getting it all right.
It hasn't happened yet. But I mean, Sabalenka virtually unbeaten for the year. So her good form continues and her serving form really as well. Like, you know, compared to last year when she was... couldn't get a serve in. But she'll be playing Coco Gauff in the quarterfinal. And the other quarterfinal is between Maria Sakkari and Petra Kvitova. Kvitova beating Jessie Pegula. I woke up this morning, looked at the live scores and saw that they had like an epic tiebreak. It's a 24-point final set tiebreak in that match, which was crazy. Kvitova saving four match points. Match of the tournament, possibly, Chris. I don't know if we're going to top that.
I think epic finishes, and you know, we love a story where someone's able to, you know, like a Murray sort of player in Kvitova, who's had an awful lot of success and a Grand Slam champion who we all kind of will on to get some great results, because when they're playing well, it is they're so well liked and they play such entertaining tennis. And all of the match points are pretty much saved by, you know, Kvitova winners. So that's something that you can't say that she ever shies away on the big points. I think she actually plays them better than some of the less significant points. But I did love at the end, new podcast favourite, Jessie Pegula, when she said, she was hugging Kvitova at the net and said, I was just hoping someone end it, you know, because the match had been going on for so long and so the tiebreak, and Kvitova burst out laughing. So, I mean, she is the realest of the real Pegula in that sense that, you know, she took it well, the loss, and just thought, you know what, neither of us want to win it, clearly, by the fact that we're still here 24 points into a tie, 23 points into a tiebreak. I was going to ask you, Kim, did you catch any of the topsy-turvy encounter that made some of the headlines between Kvitova and Ostapenko earlier in the week?
I didn't catch it, but I noticed the score and I immediately thought of Joel, actually.
He loves these.
And if scoreboard stories were still a thing, this would definitely be our scoreboard story of the week. Yeah, Ostapenko won the first set with a bagel, 6-love. Kvitova won the second set with a bagel, 6-love, but actually won 10 games in a row to go 4-love up in the third set. Then Ostapenko came back with 4 games off the trot, and then Kvitova won the last 2 games. So absolutely bizarre, I think, throughout the whole match, really. And I don't know if the tennis scoring system was any different, would we have ever seen... It baffles me how many consecutive games they could each win.
Of a match from the US Open, I think, from many years ago between Venus Williams and Kim Clijsters. If I'm correct in thinking, that was a bagel followed by a bagel, followed by maybe a 6-4 set. It could be the exact same scoreline. That's something that I'd love to find out now, to see if that is the case. Because I do think that it was... I mean, they're both big hitters as well. I can confirm... Yes, exactly. It was the exact same scoreline. 6-love, 6-4. Yeah, and that was from the 2010 semi-final of the US Open. And I just thought... And I watched that and it was quite entertaining because, you know, one of those players is playing well, they're hitting great winners, and the same with Clijsters and Venus Williams at that time. And then we got one set where they were both playing well. So that is the difference. That final set, it was almost going to serve. Whereas this one was 4-love, 4-all, 6-4. So...
Yeah, still very up and down, like very much topsy-turvy, wasn't it?
Very
but that's
much.
Very niche knowledge, the exact scoreline you remember. So
yeah,
well
just
done.
Came to me. Thanks, Kim. Why is that not par for the course this week?
No, exactly. But yeah, let's talk about... we could talk about women, WTA, you know, we could talk about it for the rest of the evening. There's been so much going on, but let's go on to the men's side of the action. Currently got Cameron Norrie against Francis Tiafoe as we're recording this.
I can see it over your shoulder, Kim. I'm actually, if it ever goes quiet, it's because I'm having a watch of that one.
Yeah, you're sneakily watching the telly behind me. You can see more of it than I can myself when I'm looking at my screen.
turning around.
Tiafoe is a setup, unfortunately, for British fans. But do you know what? Before we get onto the tennis, can I just say I love Francis Tiafoe's outfit. Definitely a fashion fave. Raspberry Ripple ice cream, I think, being the inspiration. Yeah, just love it. I think a lot of the outfits, the Nike outfits, are quite colourful, quite nice this tournament. So
I love them. I think he's made amends for his rather audacious fashion moment from the Australian Open, which I think we weren't quite sure about. But this, they had the Nike kit. I said Emma Raducanu. I said this to you earlier. 4 outfits in 4 matches, because it's you're able to swap,
chop and change.
Exactly, that's a capsule wardrobe, Kim.
Versatile and fashionable.
Will Tiafoe be in tomorrow? Who knows?
I know. I mean, also, if anyone has the, I don't know, style to pull off an audacious outfit, I do think it's Francis Tiafoe. So, yes. Yeah, very impressed. But I suppose we should actually talk about the tennis, not just what people are wearing.
Yes.
Let's look at that section of the draw, actually. So they're in the bottom half of the draw with Medvedev and Davidovich Fokina being in the other sort of section. Cam Norrie won yesterday against Rublev, straight sets, which I was quite impressed by. Hopefully he'll be able to stage a bit of a comeback against TFO. But yeah, TFO doing well to come through the draw as well. Tsitsipas had fallen from his sort of little section, lost to Jordan Thompson in a last set tiebreak earlier in the week. But I think really from this half of the draw, I'm very much looking at Medvedev to come through, given his recent run of form. You know, he's won several titles on the trot. He did have a bit of an epic with Sasha Zverev, 7-5 in the third, so just edging him. And I feel like the two of them do often have some close encounters, but this one went over 3 hours long to give Medvedev his 17th win on the trot. Do you see anyone in the draw being able to challenge Medvedev? Chris, are you kind of thinking this is going to be title number four, you know, with a couple of wins to go?
Well, I think he's pretty lucky he's in the bottom half of this draw. Obviously, we're going to talk about the top half a little bit later on, but the way the court plays, and I think that at times Alcaraz can play in quite a Świątek kind of way in terms of phenomenal mover and can also make some fantastic shots. I think he's proving he might be a bit tricky. I think we've got a few other players in there. We've got defending champion still in. I think Sinner could do some damage. Similar thing, if you move well and you're a big hitter, this is going to be the sort of court for you. So I actually think that Medvedev is not the favourite, and maybe not even the favourite to come through his next match, because the tennis that I saw, because I kind of took a seat on my sofa eagerly awaiting the Sasha Medvedev match, and what I saw in that first set, it was not good tennis. It was really, really messy, and tactically it was all over the shop. And then I was actually making a tally chart during the tiebreak, Kim. This is what I've become.
Making a tally chart.
Yeah,
I was about...
Because I was like, no one's winning points here. And in the tiebreak, there were 12 points played. So that's actually half the points of the Kvitova-Pegula tiebreak. But there were 7 unforced errors, 1 forced error, 1 drop shot winner, 2 volley winners, and 1 ace. And so it just kind of shows you that once the point had got going off the ground, I haven't seen misses like this, especially on Sasha's forehand wing. It just seemed like people weren't making the adjustments, and it reminded me of that, you know, the 2020 US Open final where I think Sasha should have got that win, but it was just this back and forth of a comedy of errors at times. And I mean, it was a bit of a farce with Medvedev on the floor injured, Sasha trying to help him up, and Medvedev saying, leave me here. And then he came on to win it. And it all just seemed a bit ridiculous, I think, all of the theatrics that went around that match.
Theatrics and Medvedev. Now, they're two words I've not heard in the same sentence before.
No, it's very unlike him. Yeah. No cameras were harmed in the making of that.
Oh, gosh. Yeah, he's also not very happy with the court, which we will actually be discussing a bit later on. Yes, I remember that US Open 2020. It did feel like no one wanted to win at one stage, and it was
a bit like this
not pretty tennis. Yeah. So it's funny, you do get some matches, don't you, where the quality is not great and therefore they
the
go down
them,
to the wire, but it's not, you know, maybe not as enjoyable as just someone playing lights out and thrashing someone, you know, but you actually get like the beautiful tennis.
Yes.
So we'll see. I still think Medvedev won't be troubled by Alejandro Davidovich Fokina, but we'll see. Maybe against, you know, a TFO or someone.
Or a Norrie. Do you think Norrie will make it through that one? What do we think?
I'd love to. I mean, Norrie's won this title before. So he's reached the quarterfinals here 3 times on the trot now. I think it's the only British player to have done that. So he obviously feels very comfortable at Indian Wells. So hopefully he can stage a bit of a comeback.
He's finding a way to win this year, Kim, isn't he? When you think he's down, he finds a way. So, and TFO's not known to be the best of closers. So there's more in that match yet, I think. And we'll update you as we go.
Yeah, definitely. We've got last year's defending champion, Taylor Fritz, also in the quarterfinals. He will be playing Jannik Sinner, who, you know, has been doing fairly well of late. But yeah, Fritz coming through, to be honest, he's had a fairly straightforward draw so far. I think really from this section, I guess one of the standout matches we saw was Stan the Man against Holger Rune. Stan still showing that he's capable of getting a, you know, a win against the, I guess, a top player, like, you know, in the third set he came through. Your pick for the tournament, I think, was Holger Rune, Chris. Are you sort of slightly regretting this after this Stan the Man match?
You know what? I really need to learn that if you predict something, it won't happen. But I just think that once you've seen someone play that well, I guess it just makes the point that they can't do it week in, week out. It is tricky and the conditions do change. So, I mean, that match, Stan should have got it done in two. So I'd say the positives from that one, I would say, is that, you know, even when Holger wasn't playing his best and he said it was actually one of the worst matches he's played, he was still able to push, you know, a former Grand Slam champion all the way and make it pretty difficult. So there are positives to take from it, but I am regretting that decision, if I'm being honest.
Yeah, it's all right. I've had far roguer predictions in my time, as I'm sure Joel has as well. But yeah, I mean, Stan subsequently lost to Jannik Sinner, who, you know, has come through quite, you know, well in straight sets so far. He's playing Fritz next. I think that one's pretty close. I wouldn't be surprised if Sinner gets
I'm backing Sinner for that
Fritz,
one,
yeah,
based on the form he's had. But I did see that some of the Fritz Ben Shelton first round match, and Ben Shelton's kicker second serve might be one of the best serves I've ever seen on the tour. I mean, someone who is as tall and has a bigger wingspan as Taylor Fritz couldn't get near it. It's almost like if we say it's like the Sam Stosur of the ATP, but maybe times two, because I've never seen kick on a serve like it. So that is one to watch. If he's 20 and he's developed that level of skill, I think we're about to see some very interesting things from him the rest of the season. I think it's just a bit unlucky that, you know, he drew Fritz in that first round, because I think he could have had a pretty good tournament here.
Yeah, needs to just develop everything else to go along with the lethal
yes,
weapon that is his kick serve.
Because yeah, ideally you'd make the first serve, right?
Well, ideally, yeah. But yeah, just talking of you know, going back to Stan, we also had another, you know, former Grand Slam champion in Andy Murray. He was in a very kind of funny section of the draw with, you know, Dan Evans and Jack Draper. So there's quite a lot of Brits just in one section. So Jack Draper, for example, you know, he beat Dan Evans, and then who was he up to play next? Andy Murray, another Brit. Jack Draper came through that one in straight sets. To set up, you know, a encounter with Carlos Alcaraz, which we were all looking forward to very much, which was, you know, sort of in our night last night. But that did not go to plan. It was 6-2, 2-love, Jack Draper retiring. You know, Alcaraz continues his way through the draw, you know, in straight sets. But yeah, a massive shame for Jack Draper there, who, you know, I mean, I don't know if he would have beaten Alcaraz, but it's always a shame to see your match end in retirement, isn't it?
Yeah, and I think it's a shame because, you know, we do know that when it comes to Jack Draper, that he does have a bit of a tendency on the physical side to struggle a little bit, especially, you know, that US Open run last year. And, you know, he had a hip issue, and then it followed with kind of a stomach muscle injury here. So, and he also, I think he had kind of heavy strapping on his right leg. So it's a big shame. And I think it just shows you even more, you know, that Andy Murray is not retiring from matches. It just shows you the conditioning, the amount of rehab he must do to be able to bounce back from. I mean, his first round match was over 3 hours. It's incredible when you think about the physicality of Murray and how he's able to do all of that with the hip, all the rehab, all the physical work to put himself in the best condition to still be competing. So that result really does kind of put into perspective the work that he does off the court. But we have to give a shout out to the fact that Andy Murray won a match in straight sets, Kim.
I know. Yeah, that's a real rarity. All of my family were like, have you heard? Andy Murray hasn't gone to a last set tiebreak.
It was done in two. It's like you have to make plans again, because when he's playing, you just cancel everything, right?
Yes, you just know it's going to go late and it's going to go down to the wire. But yeah, 6-4, 6-3 against Radu Albot.
Not even a tiebreak.
Yeah, not a tiebreak or 7-5 set in sight. So, yeah, well done, Andy. But yeah, he continues to amaze, doesn't he? I still think Andy has provided some of the, you know, best entertainment on the tour this year, in particular.
Most watchable tennis player on the tour this year, I think.
And, you know, one of the tennis players with the most heart and tenacity, which we love to see and makes him compelling to watch, you know, whatever the score is, really. Alcaraz continues, though. He's up against FAA in his quarterfinal. FAA almost didn't get there. He had to save 6 match points to beat Tommy Paul. So that was a bit of a dramatic encounter for Felix. He managed to come through by the skin of his teeth. But as a result, he has now reached the quarterfinals at the last 6 Masters events. So building that consistency at these, you know, top level tournaments, which is really good. And as a result, I'm going to put him in the quarterfinals of my Miami predictions, I think, to see if he can make it.
Yeah, I mean,
7 on the
now
trot.
We know this information, and hopefully Joel won't listen. I think we can both put him in the quarterfinals at least.
Yeah, exactly. But just needs to go a bit further, doesn't he? And actually maybe win a Masters, which would be nice. But yeah, we've got so that's our lineup, and we'll be discussing more from Indian Wells in just a moment, but we're going to take a very quick break now. But do join us in the second half, where we'll be looking at all of the other bits and bobs from the tour this week and all the action still to come from Tennis Paradise. So do not go anywhere.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee, plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to bollandbranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Welcome back to the Tennis Weekly podcast, sponsored by DownloadTennis.com. And before we get into the rest of the action, we have, for the first time in a long time, Chris, we have a mysterious player for the podcast.
We do have a mysterious player. I thought this was the perfect opportunity to try something a bit different. You know, we've had a lot of back and forths. We've had an awful lot of the highest number. And I was thinking, a mysterious player could be the perfect thing to keep you on your toes, Kim. I know you love a challenge.
I do. Thought
a topical, there's a first clue, a topical mysterious player might be something that you will relish the opportunity of guessing.
Oh, so yeah, for anyone who hasn't listened in a while or is quite new to the show, this is another game we do where Chris will present a series of clues and I will have to guess after each clue who I think it is. And technically, as you go along, the clues tend to get a bit easier. They build a bigger picture of the person. So yeah, well, let's crack on. We'll see how we go. I'll do my absolute best. But yeah, Chris, do you want to kick us off and give me the and our listeners the first clue?
Yes, this is where we insert the mysterious player jingle. Which we haven't bought yet, but
which we don't have.
We do not have, so we can imagine that. So the first clue, and this is very tricky, is that I have a career high ranking of number 2.
Ooh, that could be a number of players, couldn't it? Who only got to number 2 in the world? Oh gosh, Annette Contivate.
That is a very good guess, and that is completely accurate in the sense that she did get to number 2, but not the player.
I thought you
said
I got it right.
No.
Okay.
my best result at a Grand Slam was the semi-finals And I made it three times in Australia in 1999, 2002, and 2007.
Blimey. Okay. So three-time semi-final, all in Australia. Blimey. They must have loved the courts down there. It's not one of the Swedish players, is it? Like, was there a Johansson's flying around? Although I thought one of them won a slam. Thomas Johansson?
It's a very impressive guess. I think you're just showing off your knowledge now, but I will continue.
Okay. Well, my lack of knowledge, because I haven't got it right yet.
I think I'm learning. Okay, I might have picked this a bit hard, but it will. They do get slightly easier. I have a one-handed backhand. Not that much easier.
I just think of Federer and Stan the Man when I think of one-handed backhands and current, you know, more current players like Thiem, who in past days had a one-handed backhand and got to number two in the world, made three Australian Open semi-finals. I don't even know if it's a bloke or a woman. I don't know which tour they were playing on, which rankings they got to number two on.
I can continue.
Yeah, next clue. My mind's gone blank.
I was two sets to love up against Roger Federer at Roland Garros in 2009.
Oh. And that's the year he won it, isn't it? Because that's when Rafa had his sodling encounter.
Those two events are not connected, Kim. Sodling taking out Rafa and Federer winning it, remember? He would have won it anyway.
No, it's not. So, yeah. Oh, of course. Sorry. Yeah, any Federer. Yeah, yes. Of course he would have done.
Yes.
I do remember that he did have... There was an encounter, yeah, where he did have a... Oh. Tommy Robredo?
That's a good guess, but I will continue. I will continue. Very close. I am now a tournament director.
Oh, my God. It's... Yeah, okay. Yeah, I'm in the right vein, aren't I? Oh, and you said it was topical. Yes, okay. It is a Tommy, isn't it? It's Tommy Haas. Tommy Haas.
It is. It's Tommy Haas. Well done,
because he's the tournament director. Bit yes. slow there. Yeah, because he did get to number two, didn't he?
I was slightly surprised by that, I have to be honest. And he did win a Masters title in Stuttgart. So...
Also
a silver medalist.
That's a great one.
In singles. So there was quite a few things I could have included. Born in Hamburg, I thought probably wouldn't help.
Oh, that... No, but that might have given it away a bit
away
more.
Away too soon.
Because I could refine it down to German players.
But no, you did get it
yeah,
before
on
we
his
ran
day,
out of questions.
He was amazing, wasn't he?
So you won it before we got out
Thank
of questions.
You very
so
much.
I think that counts as a win. And let us know if you got there before Kim did.
I'm sure some of our listeners will have done.
Some have read hard on these things. But I think that was it pitched about the right level, Kim, do you reckon? Or do you want a bit more of a challenge next time?
Yeah, I think it was good. It was challenging for me. And then it kind of finally clicked. So
Joel will have to tell us how he did next week.
Yes, he'll have to let us know. let's have a look at what's in our mailbag for this week. Because our mailbag actually refers to Daniil Medvedev's comments after his recent match at Indian Wells about the court. So... Sebastian has got in contact with us via email to say, as a non-tennis playing fan, it seemed rather strange that Medvedev would say the courts in Indian Wells are not hard courts. How much of a difference does the surface make? Are the courts too slow, or does Medvedev have a point? He is referring to Medvedev's comments, which basically said that the court is not what they would call a hard court. What a shame to call this awful court a hard court. He actually said he's going to pee as slow as this court is. The court is so slow. I don't accept this. This is not hard courts, and I'm kind of just amalgamating some of his comments. They're paraphrasing, and that's what I was looking for. What do you make of his comments, Chris? And if it's not a hard court, what is it?
I mean, Kim, now that is the question. define a hard court. Well, I think it's by definition, I think we have to say it is very much a hard court. I wouldn't call it grass, and it's definitely not blue clay. It might play a little bit like blue clay, though, in some ways, but blue clay does play much quicker. But what I would say is key here is that it is a very, very slow hard court. It is still a hard court. It does play a bit more like clay. I mean, it plays probably slower than an indoor clay court. So slower than a Stuttgart, for example. I think it's because it's quite a gritty texture as well. And the conditions in the desert are that it's quite warm during the day, but Medvedev's been playing quite a lot of matches later on as well. And so it does change. So, but this is something that Medvedev has brought up multiple times, almost every time he plays in Indian Wells. He brought it up last year. We know it's a slow court. It doesn't suit his game. There are some players it does suit the game of more. And I think you kind of see, like, in the Raducanu match and in her interview afterwards, she did kind of say similar things in the sense that due to the conditions and being colder in the evening as well, it was a lot harder to kind of get the ball to the court. Whereas in her daytime matches, it was much easier because it travelled much faster and it was much livelier. So it's difficult to get kind of the same quality of shot that she was looking for. And you could see that Iga was able to get behind the ball. So I do think it does make sense that it is very slow. So it does favour those players in that sense. But I think it's definitely a mental thing with him, because if it's a very slow court, I'm not sure why you're 10 metres or 10 feet behind the baseline. And that was kind of a key thing from that match I was watching, is that he hasn't adjusted. He's almost standing in the same place that he stands, you know, on any other surface, even if it plays much more quickly than this. So it is, he has got a point. It is very slow. But I put it to you, Kim, a slow hard court is still a hard court.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, we know he loves to have a bit of a whinge. And I wonder if he goes and wins this tournament, if suddenly he'll be at peace with it.
He doesn't enjoy clay and it plays like a slow clay court.
And, you know, he's not historically had vast amounts of success on a grass court either. So, I mean, he just, yeah, it's not going to, you're never going to have the perfect court surface.
He did
for
say
what
he is
like
a hard court specialist, and that's what he knows. So that was a particular highlight, I think.
Yeah, but I mean, he has a bit of a point. Obviously, it's affecting other players, or they agree with him. But I think, you know, there comes a certain point, you can't do anything about it. That is the condition. Mm. So
Sebastian,
you kind of have
no
to accept
slower than last
that.
Year. Exactly.
Yeah. But thanks, Sebastian, for your question. Please do let us know, anyone, if you've got any questions for the mailbox, the mailbag, I should say. We don't physically have an actual postbox.
PO box.
But, you know, always happy to answer them. So let's take a bit of, let's have a look at the news out in the tennis world. A bit of challenger related gossip, actually, Chris, for the week. There's a Phoenix challenger happening where a lot of top players have been signed up to it. So we've got the likes of Matteo Berrettini, Gael Monfils, Diego Schwartzman. They're due to play this event, which, you know, it's for a challenger, you'd never normally get that caliber of players. But even more bizarre, Novak Djokovic was invited to play a challenger in Italy because he's not playing, you know, in Indian Wells. And we don't think he's going to be at Miami as well. So a challenger event in Italy have made a sort of last ditch efforts to get Novak to play in San Remo in Italy. Now, the likes of Berrettini and co, they are allowed to play at the Challenger in Phoenix, but Djokovic isn't allowed to play at the Challenger in Italy. Chris, why is that? What are the rules around challengers and sort of who can and can't play them? Because I wasn't really aware of this until now.
Well, I think it's a shame because it sounds like the tournament that invited Novak Djokovic also weren't aware of it, even if he did wish to play it. But the rule, an article 707 of the ATP rulebook state, players positioned between 1 and 10 in the ATP singles rankings 21 days prior to the first Monday of the ATP Challenger Tour tournament are prohibited from entering, accepting a wildcard and/or competing in an ATP Challenger Tour tournament. So it's very definitive in that sense. But I do think something that's quite interesting about this is that 1 to 10... I mean, the difference between a 10 and 11 is pretty minimal. And you feel like it would be a much more natural cutoff would be the top 20. Because you can see some people maybe playing with provisional ranking, for example. It's unlikely that you would be playing that if you were kind of in a 1 to 10. But it feels like a bit of an odd cutoff point. What do you think about that, Kim?
Yeah, I wasn't actually aware that they had a cutoff. I know we've seen like big names at challenges before, but that's always been when they've dropped down the rankings because of injury or what have you. So I guess I'd never actually thought about, you know, a world number one playing a challenger. I agree there should be some sort of ranking cutoff because it's not fair otherwise, you know, because that person is then denying, you know, a player who relies on the challenger tour, you know, it's denying them their, you know, spot in the draw. So, and Novak Djokovic doesn't need to play this tournament. Obviously, the tournament would love him to be there.
Be quite
imagine
fun
that
if he
the
did,
draw
though,
that
now, if he turned
it would
up
bring
with a gelato,
for the crowd,
a vegan gelato, yeah,
yeah. Just fancied a trip to San Remo. Well, he did play there in 2005 and he won the event. So they, you know, think it's kind of great marketing to have, you know, previous champion
he just goes
coming
there
back.
Anyway, presents the trophy.
Yeah, he could do. I mean, he, you know, I think he speaks Italian. He's, you know, doesn't he only lives down the road. San Remo is super close to Monte Carlo. You can get there in a day on the train. So they could entice him.
He's gave the
somehow
train,
they've
he?
Got a whole hashtag for yeah, we'll see, he has to change at Ventimiglia and swap over from the French train to the Italian train. Definitely gonna see Novak doing that. But yeah, I mean, on the other side, we've got the Phoenix Challenger where, you know, Berrettini and co are playing and perhaps, yeah, they shouldn't, should they be allowed to play? Because that's also taking spots away from players who would be relying on playing that Challenger. So it isn't really totally fair. Maybe they should extend the, you know, the rankings cut off to 20, 30, I don't know.
Yeah, I can see that. I'd say for this one, I think it's quite unusual, you know, that we've got to consider the timing of it because these players have been eliminated from the tournament in the first week of Indian Wells. So therefore, they have a free week where they're hopefully looking to fine-tune some of their skills on the way over to Florida. So this is in Phoenix. So obviously, it is kind of almost en route.
Sort of.
So, like, it is an odd time when there are players who are looking for a bit of fine-tuning. So, it's a bit of an unusual one. So, I'm not sure how big a problem it is because I'm not sure many top 10 players would be looking to play challenges at any point, as you say. But
true.
A bit of an anomaly. But for people at Phoenix, head down and check out some top-level tennis.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it's a great opportunity. And, yeah, the other thing that's kind of come to light this week out in Indian Wells, we've had quite a lot of contentious issues and talking points with regards to the, you know, the Russian invasion of Ukraine and the ongoing war and conflict. You know, sadly, this is something that is affecting, you know, all sectors and areas, including sport. And we've seen a fair number of things coming out on the tennis circuit this week. We've had Potapova wearing a Spartak Moscow team jersey on court. She walked onto her match, which, you know, was not a great look, really, and there were lots of, you know, reservations from other players about that. We've had Yelena Ostapenko having her funding cut by the Latvian Tennis Federation because she plays tournaments where Belarusians and Russians also participate. And we've also had Ukrainian Lesha Serenko pulling out of her match against Arina Sabalenka, who's Belarusian, of course, after comments from the WTA chief executive gave her what she called a panic attack. So a lot to unpack here, Chris. Don't really know where to start because there's quite a lot of, quite negative, but also, you know, harrowing kind of, feelings still surrounding a lot of the players. Anastasia Potapova wearing a Moscow, you know, Spartak Moscow football shirt. Is that, you know, do you think that was intentional? Do you think that was just insensitivity? She wasn't really, you know, aware, or do you think she, you know, how much did that provoke, you know, reaction?
It's definitely avoidable, I would say. You know, I think it's, she said that she's been a fan of them since she was 13. She meant nothing by it. But I still think at the same time, we have seen players wearing, you know, national jerseys a little bit more coming onto court, being a bit more playful in their attire heading onto court. But I think you have to be much more aware that if you are kind of representing or sporting, you know, a Moscow or a Russian team in this instance, it is going to send a certain message of support. And especially because in all of the international football ties and competitions, whilst the conflict, whilst the invasion and the war goes on, they're banned from playing. So it is one where showing that you support them could also be a sign that you're showing that you support them despite kind of the restrictions they have for playing. And again, completely avoidable. You'd think that she would know that that wouldn't be a good look or a good idea. And maybe maybe it's something where the WTA needs to be a bit clearer in terms of whether you're able to kind of voice your support for Russia in some ways, because some things are obviously cultural and some things are have a bit more sort of intention behind it, which could be misinterpreted. But it lends itself, I mean, we were debating this earlier, Kim, weren't we, in terms of Wimbledon. There is talk that Wimbledon will be allowing Belarusians and Russians to participate. And I mean, surely Potapova wouldn't be allowed to do this. If she was allowed back to Wimbledon, this would be a violation, I imagine.
Yeah, we're expecting that Wimbledon will allow Russians and Belarusians to play this year, but that would be under a neutral flag, not a national flag or anything. But yeah, certainly I would imagine there should be strict guidelines about the behaviour and what you can and can't do around your nationality. And certainly wearing a football shirt, you know, it's not a Russian football shirt of the national team, but it's still of a Russian club. And I think Wimbledon would absolutely not allow that. And I think after this sort of instance, the WTA and ATP should probably just clarify with some guidelines. I know Iga Swiatek spoke out about this sort of incident and said she was very surprised and that, you know, Potapova should have realised that it's not, you know, really appropriate to show her views in this way. And, you know, maybe Potapova, it was an honest mistake, but I'm sure she'll hopefully learn from that because it doesn't have a good look. And especially, you know, in light of we had comments from Lesya Cherenko, who pulled out of her match against Sabalenka. We don't know if that's because, you know, she couldn't face playing Sabalenka, who's Belarusian, but she did come out and say that she had a conversation with the CEO of the WTA, who kind of was basically saying that, you know, he himself does not support the war, but if players from Russia and Belarus support it, then this is only their own opinion and the opinion of other people should not upset me, i.e. upset Cherenko. So this is what Cherenko was saying anyway. Basically, she was implying that Steve Simon had kind of just told her to, like, get on with it. And if, you know, if the Russian and Belarusian players did support the war, like, she shouldn't be upset by that. But that's a bit of insensitivity going on there. I think maybe it was lost in, I don't know, translation. We don't actually know, you know, we weren't involved in that conversation. That's her interpretation. So we don't know if that's exactly what was said, but obviously those comments don't look good either. You know, coming out and, you know, from the CEO of the WTA. So, and obviously it's causing Cherenko quite a lot of anxiety and panic attacks and all of that. You know, her mental health, and I think she's had quite a lot of withdrawals from events and tournaments, I think, you know, since the war started, basically. So just shows, you know, the struggles that are ongoing with like Ukrainian players, basically, who, you know, are trying to forge a career and survive on the tour with all of this going on, and comments like that just aren't very helpful.
They aren't helpful, but I think it does kind of remind me, and I'm not comparing war to people's views on the LGBTQ plus community. But I do think it is sort of similar to the idea that, you know, someone like Margaret Court, who's made her views very clear about what she thinks, and that's her belief about which I think lots of people don't share those views and we don't condone them at all. I think it's one where that's someone she still has a court named after her, and players are sometimes expected to play on that court. And so I think some people will have personal views that you don't agree with, and that many would think are bigoted in many ways, or could be interpreted as that. So I think it is this thing where you can see what he was saying, but I do think it was completely insensitive to say that it shouldn't upset, because if you're playing against someone who is actively supporting something that is, you know, destroying your country, and I think that would be very distressing. So I think it is this difficult position between personal opinions and not discriminating against people like Margaret Court or people who have opinions that we don't agree with. But it is just finding the line of trying to separate the tennis from the politics. And I think we're just finding that it's so intertwined and there's so much confusion and differences in how governments and institutions are handling it. Like, I know the Ostapenko story that we're going to talk about now is that, you know, she can't control what happens in the tournaments, but her funding's been cut because she plays tournaments where Russians and Belarusians are playing, irrespective of anyone's views or what she supports. So it feels like we're getting into this weird view where sometimes what you think does matter, like you have to say you don't support something, then other ones, it doesn't matter because you're just even there participating and therefore that's a problem. So that one is a tricky one. But I think the only positive for her in that is that I don't think she'll be missing the $1,700 she was receiving a month from them, because I think she's making a fair bit more than that. But it obviously is symbolic that any Latvian player who wants to become a tennis player, who wants to play in these tournaments, will not get funding, which is quite shocking, Kim.
Yeah, because this Ostapenko story, now it's the Latvian Olympic Committee basically decided that Latvian athletes would be suspended if they participated in sporting events that were attended by Russian and Belarusian players. So, yeah, obviously, Yelena Ostapenko attending a tournament where there's Russian and Belarusians there, even though those Russian and Belarusians are playing under, you know, not their flag, but they're playing as neutrals. There's nothing to do with Ostapenko, is it, in the sense of she's got to play Indian Wells if she wants to forge a career and earn money. So, yeah, I don't think she's got a choice. She's having her government funding suspended. But like you said, she'll be winning prize money.
But she's done, it's tricky, sure, right? Because, you know, she's done a lot for her country in Latvian tennis by winning the French Open and representing her country at the Billie Jean King Cup. So it is an odd move, and hopefully one that won't be emulated around the globe, because it doesn't quite seem fair, especially for those players who aren't earning as much as her.
Yeah, players who absolutely rely on the, you know, government funding, you know, the sporting kind of bodies from in their countries, like this is would be, you know, crippling for them potentially financially. So a very unique reaction, I suppose. And I guess with the war, you know, and how it interplays with sport, we do see all these sorts of different ways of going about it. And, you know, some we may agree with, some we don't. And yeah, it's sort of unpicking them as they come up. So, let's have a look before we finish for...
how's Norrie doing?
This episode. Oh, how's Norrie doing? Oh, Francis Tiafoe is serving for the match. So he's not doing too well, actually. It's looking like it could be a standard 6-4, 6-4 job. I'm sure by the time we finish, it may well be over. Yeah, so we've got Alcaraz against Felix Auger-Aliassime, Taylor Fritz against Jannik Sinner, Daniil Medvedev against Alejandro Davidovich Fokina, and possibly, yeah, looking likely to be TFO having beaten Norrie. On the women's side, we've got Świątek against Kosteja, Mukova, Rybakina, Sakkari versus Kvitova, and Goff versus Sabalenka. Oh, see, that's... yeah, tricky to pick out two winners, or two finals and winners, Chris. Let's see. Are you sticking with your previous predictions? Norrie prediction. You're still on for a Świątek Sabalenka final. Are you sticking with that?
I'm going to stick with that one. I'll take that one. And then I'd say, if I was going to say based on what I've seen, I would love it if Sinner came through and took a Masters title. Mm-hmm. I really would like that. So that's what I'm going to say now. What about you? Are you sticking with yours? Because it can still happen.
He's overdue one, isn't he? Yeah. So I wasn't here last week for your predictions when you unveiled them, but I did have Świątek Sabalenka as my final, but I've gone for Sabalenka to win. I'm going to stick with that. They're both still in the draw. So why not? Why wouldn't I? but on the men's side, I had a Fritz Medvedev final, which also is still on. And I've got Medvedev winning.
Well done, Kim. Funny that. When were these predictions made?
I know.
Just before we went live.
Don't be silly, Christopher.
No, I can see that Rublev is in there. I can see.
I had some players that have fallen by the wayside, like Caroline
Garcia.
You're just very
good at this, I think. That's the problem, Kim.
I also thought Paula Badosa was going to resurrect her form when she won this title. And I had her in the semi-finals, but that didn't go to plan. Although I can see you had Sloane Stephens in the semi-final.
Point made.
I'm just like laying into your predictions and I can hardly talk. But yeah, we'll see when we catch up next week how they all panned out. And we'll be back to catch up on the rest of Indian Wells. Cameron Norrie has just lost, so the Raspberry Ripple outfit of Frances Tiafoe continues, which I'm quite pleased about. Get to look at it again for another match, because I want a top or a dress in that colour combination. I really want to buy his outfit, basically.
We should
love it.
See if we can get a sponsor that will send you it.
I could. I've got some weddings coming up in April. Do you think that would work?
That'd be
like
lovely.
Wedding
lovely.
Print?
Really nice. Yeah. Belt it, heel it, statement lip, and you're good to go.
Listeners, I hope you have enjoyed our latest episode of the Tennis Weekly podcast. Remember to subscribe to us to stay up to date on all of the action from the ATP and WTA tours. We're on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and all major podcasting platforms out there. And if you like what you're hearing, then make sure to leave us a rating and review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify as well.
You can also follow us on social media or email the show. We're on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at Tennis Weekly Pod. You can email the show at tennisweeklypod@gmail.com or check out our website, tennisweekly.co.uk.
And we'll be back next week at Tennis Weekly HQ for another episode. So I hope you can join us for that. But in the meantime, it's goodbye from Chris.
Goodbye.
And it's goodbye from me. We'll see you all again soon.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.